Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking quite a bit about the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, and we've got a judicial perspective on it and a media perspective on it as well. Hadley Arkus joins us now for both a personal reflection and some judicial thoughts on the life and legacy of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Hadley's a regular guest, professor of American Institutions Emeritus at Amherst College, founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding, and author of the book Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, The Touchstone of the Natural Law. Hadley, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me on, Todd. Very good to hear from you.
You have recently written very poignantly of Nino Scalia, and you said this: some of my friends are preparing to go into oral arguments at the court this term on abortion, on the Little Sisters of the Poor, and on other cases. And with Nino no longer there, they seem to have lost their fighting chance to prevail. That bleakness will hang over the courtroom in those days soon coming. But worse than that, we will feel in that courtroom the loss of his voice, the sense of solidarity and sharp wit, engaged so quickly. And yet, most of all, we'll feel the absence of that figure we had come to count on as that senior grown-up in the room, helping to anchor it all. What do you mean by that senior grown-up in the room?
It did mean that there weren't other grown-ups in the room. Sam Alito is quite the grown-up, and so is John Roberts and Clarence Thomas. That Nino was the strongest voice, and you could count on him always to be raising the most fundamental questions, as with the question of, how did you get here? Do you have the standing to present this suit? That is, what he understood was that the court was not simply a third chamber of the legislature. You just don't come to the court to get other opinions. The court has to deal with cases where people have suffered an injury. And if the court holds back its hand from taking the case, then power is left in hands of other people, namely people who have an elective office, who are responsible to the people. So that was a very keen concern of his, and it could be manifested in such a prosaic thing, such as, how did this case get here? You know, we had this case on, he even took a tough line on this, and the case, one of the cases on same-sex marriage, Hollingsworth from, 2013, coming from California, maybe testing the Defense of Marriage Act and the national definition of marriage of man and woman. Well, the federal court struck down that act and essentially installed same-sex marriage. The Obama administration wouldn't defend it, and Nino said, well, what's the issue? There's no quarrel here. It's uncontested by the federal government. There was no standing to sue. But put that aside, you could always count on the fact that he would have the question that pierces to the very core and tests the argument of both sides at the center of things and with the willingness to voice it. As I pointed out in that piece, it wasn't always the case that the action in these oral arguments is as active as it's been. I mean, I mentioned the fact that Nino himself, when he was arguing cases before the court years ago, reported that one time he argued he was getting no questions at all, and only at the end did Justice White, Byron White, sort of try to be nice to him by giving him some attention by asking a question. These used to be rather quiet affairs. But when Nino arrived there, it took on the quality of a seminar. And now it is so active, as if the judge is pressing the argument, testing the argument from either side. And he has some interesting angles for not doing it. And Clarence's view is that he could tell you what the vote's going to be by the time they walk in. And his view is that some of these people arguing before the court may be there, coming from the states, maybe an attorney general from the states. This may be the only time in their lives they will be before the court. They may have their wives, children, relatives in with them, and then his question is, what are you going to do? By your tough questions, you make them look like idiots in front of their family? No, let them make their argument. But that style shifted a long while ago. And I remember being in one case on partial birth abortion in the argument was earlier than that, with Ruth Ginsburg just bearing down on Stenberg arguing for the state of Nebraska to defend their law on partial birth abortion. Ginsburg just bearing down like a train going at this guy. And it took Nino to come in there to kind of divert this and rescue him and say, my goodness, who's going to play that role now? Well, Sam Alito would do it. John Roberts could do it. But no one was there as steadfast as Nino in wit, but also in that real sense of focus, to focus this thing on the most decisive parts of the case. And even if he were inclined to your position and he didn't find that argument persuasive, you were in trouble. So it was just the sense of somebody so thoroughly solid and reliable who represented what the law should be in its most demanding voice and demanding sensibility. And I can't tell you what it's going to be like to go into that chamber in the next few weeks without him there.
You have written in First Things several aspects of his jurisprudence, and one of them really is a quality that he had to, it wasn't prescience as much as it simply was seeing, like you said a moment ago, seeing the argument even in its nascent form and where it will go. And you cite there, I think, the Texas case on homosexuality.
Gay rights and homosexuality. But his forte that was simply seeing the dimension, the implications of the principles, you know, where they moved. You know, he'd say, look, you struck down these, you said people were relying on this right to abortion. Look at all the reliance interests here that people have. For example, if you were saying to us that two grown-ups can seek autonomy for their consensual sexual relations, so, well, there goes the laws on prostitution, right? The laws on adultery, laws on prostitution. But Justice Kennedy and Justice O'Connor insisted that this decision, simply to recognize that homosexual couples, gays and lesbians, are seeking autonomy for these private relations, that does not entail a decision for same-sex marriage. And Nino said at the time, that famous phrase, do not believe it. And it's not a matter of looking in the crystal ball. He was seeing where the principles led or what conclusions they should have entailed. For example, so if you want to say, and this began in Romer versus Evans in 1996, he called this one, well, where the court with Justice Kennedy essentially said that there are no grounds in which the laws of any state could articulate or hold an adverse position on the homosexual life. It may not cast a moral judgment on the homosexual. It cannot say anything about the wrongness of a homosexual life, that this mode of sexuality must stand on the same plane of legitimacy as any other form of sexuality, including that sexuality, as we used to say, imprinted in our natures and the fact that we are born men and women. Now, you establish that point, and then they say, again, the state has no business casting a moral judgment and passing a law on sodomy because they morally disapprove of the homosexual life. So, all right, once those are in place, then you reach this point. The laws on marriage, open marriage only to couples of opposite sexes. It withholds the privilege of marriage from couples of the same sex. The only possible ground for holding that position is that the laws are casting an adverse judgment on the homosexual life, and therefore it becomes inadmissible to withhold the privileges of marriage from couples of the same sex. It's all plain. So, Nino, it's just a matter, as I used to say, when the second shoe is going to drop. But it's all being prepared for us. You know, that line of Lincoln's years ago, we have the sense that people have been bringing us to a point, preparing us for the next little piece of timber to be put in place to complete the construction of the house. And that's what he saw. Again, it wasn't a crystal ball. It's that he took the principles seriously and saw what they entailed.
Hadley Arkus is our guest. We're talking about the legacy of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. We'll come back to his legacy as a jurist, but when we come back, Hadley's first conversation with Antonin Scalia before he was Justice Scalia. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Wednesday afternoon, February the 17th, we're talking about the legacy of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Hadley Arkus is our guest. He's professor of American Institutions Emeritus at Amherst College. He is founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding and author of the book Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of the Natural Law. Hadley, I want to come back to Scalia's legacy as a jurist in a few minutes, but more of personal reflection from you, if we could. Recount for us your first conversation with Antonin Scalia before he was Justice Scalia.
Oh, the first one? Good gosh, no, this goes back almost 40 years. When I was a fellow at the Wilson Center, Woodrow Wilson Center, at the Smithsonian, I was like a 36-year-old professor at Amherst, and he was like 41 at the time. And I was doing a paper on racial preferences in public policy and busing and things like that. And we needed a commentator. And one friend of mine said we could bring in Antonin Scalia, who's now at the American Enterprise Institute. And I get this call. Guy on the phone says, "Hadley, this is Nino Scalia." Yeah, I didn't know him. He was right away. It's Hadley and Nino. And he was a first-rate lawyer. He had been in the Ford administration in the very prestigious Office of Legal Counsel, the office that gives advice to the Attorney General on these constitutional questions. Then he said, but then he was turned out with the Ford administration when, as he said, the people threw us out. They threw out Gerald Ford. So he had landed at the American Enterprise Institute as an intermediate step before going back to his real vocation as a teacher. He was going back now to teach at the University of Chicago. He had been at Virginia, but now he's going to the University of Chicago, where he found a very congenial home. But he came in, gave a paper, and I remember saying something that day about how to think a law that runs counter to the views of 40% of the population should be regarded as a law. I remember saying at the time, now, Nino, hold on. If 40% of the public were reserved about Pythagorean theorem, you wouldn't take that to shake your confidence in the theorem. The question is what the reasoning of that stands behind the law. It may be imprudent to enforce a law that elicits that kind of opposition, but we're into an argument. Then remember, about 20 years later, I got this. We stayed in touch, and then he called me and said, there's the last Scalia child at home, the ninth child, Meg, was interested in Amherst. And he said, well, I figure if this place has tolerated you for 30 years, it can't be all that bad. But is it really worth whatever it was, $30,000 a year? And I could send her for half that price that cost to William and Mary. And I said, are you kidding? None of them is worth that kind of money. But we can thread her through to the court, really good people and the courses she loved, and she did. But we kept in touch over the years. The families got closer, and they became very dear to us. We had a private mass on Sunday. Father Paul Scalia called me into it, and the family, we were all getting together for just a private gathering with the family. There's just three of us outside the family who were there, Clarence Thomas and his wife Ginny and I, and we hung on with the family, and it's just people have been in touch with me as though I'm part of the bereaved. I don't understand this. I think it's they want to get in touch with the family. They don't know how, so they send it to me. And I was with my own wife died. People say, don't worry about you. Judy's in a better place. Judy's in good hands now. And I think Nino's in good hands now. But the people who are just, I'm worried about it, just the flesh and blood, those wonderful children who just carry the sorrow in their bones, and they're holding together beautifully right now, and handsomely, and you could feel it. And but so it's a story that goes back a long while. We've had many, many arguments over the years about natural law, with him just being very dismissive of natural law, professes to like it, but insists that he can't apply it as a judge. And we said, no, you think it's some kind of theory hovering out there rather than the very grounds of your practical judgment. So I used to say and point out in the piece that he was persistently scoffing, dismissive of natural law, while persistently giving us examples of how that kind of jurisprudence could be handsomely done. He was persistently going beyond the text of the Constitution to those principles that were there before the Constitution, the principles that would be there even if there were no Constitution.
He also, and you alluded to this just a moment ago, he also attended your wife's funeral. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was a memorial mass, and in the small chapel, the chapel of the Catholic Information Center in Washington, 15th and K, where I came into the church myself, and my wife just loved that little chapel. I had my children in, a couple of cousins, and I was in the first row. Father Arne Panula did the mass for us, and Nino and Maureen were just right behind us. And when it came to kneeling, there were no kneelers. I was in the first row. And that floor was painful, that moment. And somehow, then I suddenly feel the cushion being put under my knees. And it was Nino sitting behind me who saw it. He could see what's going on, and he just took this cushion and placed it there. And his wife, Maureen, said just the other day, she said, you know, I saw him do that. I was just surprised. I'm surprised that he'd have sort of just taken it upon himself to do it. And I just had a note the other day from a dear friend, David Forte in Cleveland, who was there in the chapel at the time. And he remembered Nino doing it. He said he was, there he was, he's just looking out for you, trying to protect you the way he was trying to protect us all. It was a characteristic moment. The other part of it, I suppose, is that he had this large nature. We're a real Christian. They're part of the kind of Christian loving. So how did you get so close? You know, he was sort of worried about me after Judy died, and I remember sending him a note at Chambers saying, "Don't worry, I'm not coming apart." And I get a note from him saying, "Oh, it's all right." I was starting to worry. No, I'm all right. But it's a kind of a friend of mine said, "No, he was kind of a Christian love that made him so worry about you," and he had this. It must be this Christian perspective. He's willing to find the good, even people he was at odds with. You know, he and Ruth Ginsburg, and Ruth and Marty Ginsburg and their family spent off every New Year's Eve together until I think Marty Ginsburg died. And Ruth has been just at odds with him on everything. He's been furious with her. And yet we go to dinner over at their place, and, you know, the Alitos would be there, but then also you'd find Nina Totenberg, of all people, to be there. And he would find something good in other people at odds with him, and he helped to create this aura of civility that, yes, we can get along. And that built enormous respect for him, even among people on the other side. It didn't deter them from voting against him. My God, I remember being at lunch with him when Elena Kagan was coming on. I said, "Well, have you met your new colleague?" And she said, "She's a great gal. She won't vote with me, but she's a great gal." And when she was dean at the law school at Harvard, she would reach out to me. She was very dear about doing that. And so he's very congenial. Until that last year, that last term, putting in same-sex marriage, he was just so appalled by the non-law of it, by the unreasoning nature of it, that he's really beginning to lose both his confidence and his affection for his colleagues. And I remember him saying to me once, I don't even know if I could go in and have lunch with those people anymore. It's getting bad. A few weeks ago, coming out of St. John's the Beloved, sometimes I used to go there because his son Paul was the minister. And sometimes Nina would come in. I'd be leaving after the 10:30 Mass, and he'd be coming in for a Latin Mass around noon. Well, I was out there on the road talking to some friends, and I see my friends lighting up because a driver's coming down the road aimed at me. And the driver happens to be Nina. And Nina rolls by, and he says, "Ah, Hadley, are you reduced now to lecturing in the street?" And I caught him, and I said, "Look, I'm just defending you. It's like Groucho's line about Margaret Dumont. I was fighting for her honor, which is more than she ever did." And I caught him later, and he said, I may have only a year and 3 months to go. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, if I'm not going to get any help, if the liberals with this next administration, and it's going to be like this every day, I'm going to be writing, I'll just be so disheartened. I don't think I could continue. And you can see how disheartened he really was. Now, when I mentioned those cases, I ran into Greg Katz, a dear friend who's going to be arguing before the court on March 21st. I forget the case. It's not abortion, not Little Sisters of the Poor, but he said it's going to be very hard. We can't get the 5-5 votes. Now, what for this side? He said, but the outcomes will be different because if it's simply a 4-4 vote on this case on abortion coming from Texas, then a 4-4 vote simply affirms the decision in the lower court. And this time, the decision in this lower court affirmed the laws that required people doing abortions to have access privileges at local hospitals in case anything went wrong. That put a certain kind of pressure on these abortion clinics. Now, that one could come out the right way, but the thing that really jarred me was Regeg, as Clarence Thomas pointed out to me, these are the rules of the court that even so, some of these decisions have been made. For example, on racial preferences in University of Texas, the decisions have been made. Scalia's vote has been cast, but until that decision, the vote, the outcome is announced by the court, in open court, and the final decision printed, you've got to have all members of the court there. And if he's no longer there, his vote no longer counts. So this really unsettles all those cases that have been decided but not yet announced. But that simply is just one measure of the sense among people in my circle of just how much our own lives have been unsettled, and it affects are just going to radiate outward.
Hadley Arkus is our guest. We're talking about the legacy of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. When we come back, we'll talk a bit about his dissents. Stay tuned.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Hadley Arkus is our guest. We're reflecting on the legacy of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Hadley, I think one of the most interesting things about any of these justices, and all of them are fascinating figures, both present and in history, are their dissents, what they write when they're in the minority. Talk, if you would, about Antonin Scalia's dissents.
They were powerful. And I said at one point that when he was in dissent, I'd always read the dissent first, because then I'd see what is the kind of argument that the majority decision will have to beat. Whatever it is, I think, you know, Nino probably had a fine angle on it. A couple of times, you know, the hope is one day his position will be vindicated. In a couple of cases, like this case on the independent counsel, he was the only voice in opposition. And yet a friend points out to me recently that this question of whether you can have a scheme of prosecution, an independent counselor who's responsible to no one, and this is all taken outside the executive branch, it's a prosecutor responsible to no one. Absolutely, should be inconceivable. And now, a friend mentioned that there was another case recently, a couple of cases that are really bringing things Nino's way. But he has staked out the strongest positions in principle. He's given us the most telling critique of the logic behind those decisions. And those dissents of his are going to be there to be read by anyone in the future, which means it's entirely conceivable that anybody coming later will be able to recover the force of his argument if they can simply read again those powerful opinions he wrote. But if it's not done, you know, we may be turning into a kind of dark ages where you find people just don't reason anymore. And you've got, I see public opinion polls, and only 30% of the public had absolutely no awareness of Scalia, letting alone know what he had done. Yet, if we come to a point where that capacity to reason about these things in reason a demanding way has fled from most of the lawyers who are appointed as judges, nevertheless, those writings are there. Like the Federalist Papers, I mean, people, even judges, seem to be surprised when we take them through some of the Federalist Papers to see how luminous were these accounts of what the purpose, what the reasoning was, the principles lying behind these decisions made at the time of the founding. Even judges are surprised by it. In fact, judges who have never read the Federalist Papers. And if that can happen, you may find people later years just delighted and surprised to have the situation illuminated again for them by reading these writings so crisply clear and so forcefully done.
Then on that topic so near and dear to your heart, with upon which you and Justice Scalia disagreed, natural law. You mentioned that, you know, he said, I like the idea, but I can't apply it as from the bench. I can't apply natural law from the bench. But you said he gave numerous examples of how it exists. Do you think he understood your point there, that
this is
the foundation?
No, he never did. He was constantly resisting. I had the family on my side, and boyhood friends of his were on my side, and he still wouldn't do it. You know, I pointed out to him many places, you know, like the example of he's persistently, you know, the Second Amendment case about the right to bear arms, and he invoked the principle of self-defense. I said, I presume you meant the right of an innocent person to fend off an unjustified assault. He's absolutely right. I said, well, those words are not in the Second Amendment. So were you appealing to some deep principle that doesn't depend on the Second Amendment for its validity? Or were you saying, a lot of people wrote about the right to self-defense. Many founders read them. In which case, we have to find out how many of the founders read Blackstone on self-defense and incorporated that. And even if we got the answer to that question, which we can't, it's still not the question to the answer. The answer to the question we're asking, which is there in fact a deep principle that establishes the rightness of having access to a weapon if it's necessary to defend an innocent person? And he himself said this was pre-constitutional. That principle's there. And there's so many of these things. My right to be presumed innocence to proven guilty. The founders persistently made their way to those deep principles to be able to explain the decisions they were making. You know, Justice Marshall once said that the Constitution gives the Congress the power to punish only piracies on the seas. But my gosh, if the Congress can establish the mails, it must be able to protect the mails against theft and punish theft of mails. So he drew it back to the very logic of a national government. I remember one case on wetlands when Justice Kennedy, when the government was trying to, just federal government was trying to reach anything that was remotely wet, and Justice Kennedy was making the case that it should cover things, ditches with water adjacent, affecting wetlands. And Nino leaned in to make the point that, yes, but that which is like navigable waters is not itself navigable waters. And I'd say, Nino, it's simply a matter of propositional logic. The natural law found its ground in the laws of reason. And what was so distinct to the nature of human beings was access to those laws of reason. You don't need, it's not a lofty theory hovering overhead that you have access to these standards of reason. Making these, well, he'd say, well, we can't get agreement on that. No. On those deep principles always elicit agreement because they're matters of common sense. So you take, for example, what Kant or James Wilson considered the first law of practical judgment. We don't hold people responsible or blameworthy for acts they were powerless to effect. If Smith was in the hospital when the crime was done, if Smith hadn't been born when the crime was done, we take that as powerful evidence for his innocence. It's one of those things you grasp per se note as true in itself. There's so many of those principles on which the Constitution was founded. Nino was persistently making his way back to those principles, but without any awareness that he was, quote, doing natural law. So as I said, it's rather like that character Molière who discovers that he's been speaking prose all his life. And it's rather like this, except Nino sort of never really wanted to recognize that he was doing natural law. As I said, this is a conversation perhaps I can resume with him later when I see him again.
Well, and yet, and that's kind of an irony that you've pointed out here, in maybe his life, as we reflect upon it, his discouragement at the end that you described before with the Obergefell decision. You said the non-law of it, the unreasoning nature of it. What really frustrated him there was that it was no longer dealing with the law, natural or otherwise. Do you share his expressed discouragement about the future of the court?
If a liberal administration really starts appointing people to the lower federal courts, as well as the Supreme Court, it's going to be appointing people from the academic left, the people who say, you know, look, I've been facing this for years. The people guided by the dominant orthodoxies in the campus of postmodernism, radical feminism, say there are no natural rights. There are no moral truths. No moral truths grounded in a fixed human nature, because there is no fixed human nature. What you call nature is simply socially constructed from one place to another according to the vagaries of the local culture. So by their lights, there are no moral truths holding in this and other places. There is no nature that becomes the source of those rights. The founders' generation thought that it was wrong to rule dogs and horses in the way we rule human beings. And even in this age of animal liberation, we don't sign labor contracts with horses or cows or seek the informed consent of our household pets before we authorize surgery on them. But we still continue to think that we should, when we deal with beings who can give and understand reasons and make commitments, we should be able to justify what we're doing, give them reasons, and eliciting their consent. Well, to say that is to say there are certain deep differences that separate human beings from other animals, and the rights that arise for human beings in that way will be the same in all places, at all times, where that nature remains the same and human beings can be distinguished from animals. That was the understanding of the founders. That's the understanding that's been eclipsed in our own time. It is rejected at the root by the people who form the academy in our own time, and those are the people who will be projected into the bench. And if we go back to liberal administrations making these appointments, it would be very dark indeed. But at the same time, we have to recover, even among the conservatives, the sense that these reasons matter. I mean, I don't know if you have another minute, but there's a difference between the way Scalia and I would do the issues, the question of marriage. Because he would simply say it says nothing about marriage in the Constitution, and therefore there is no constitutional right that judges are in a position to declare. We said, well, it said nothing about marriage when the court struck down the laws on marriage, the laws that barred marriage across racial lines in Virginia back in 1967. So you had to explain then why a law that barred marriage, why race was irrelevant to the matter of marriage. The same way, it was necessary to explain why the complementarity of the sexes was quite necessary to the to marriage rightly understood. Our conservative judges did not do that. They did not summon the ark. They thought they could get by simply by saying, marriage is not in the Constitution. It goes back to the people in the political arena. The other side made a moral argument. They said it was wrong to bar marriage to people of the same sex. It was a bad moral argument, but instead of showing why it was a bad moral argument, the conservative jurists were simply content to say it's not in the Constitution. Well, as Herman Cain used to say, how's that all been working for us? The other side makes moral arguments, and our guys offer some mechanistic view of the Constitution because they're afraid of taking on moral reasoning. They think there's something arbitrary about moral reasoning. Whereas they have to be engaged in moral reasoning all the time without being aware that they're doing it. So that may not be a happy prospect I'm giving you, but I'm giving you, you know, Woody Allen said, I'm sorry I can't leave you with something positive. Would you accept two negatives? I'm sorry I can't leave you happier, but I'm trying to give you my cool assessment of where we are right now.
Hadley Arkus is Professor of American Institutions Emeritus at Amherst College. He's founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding. And he's author of the book Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of the Natural Law. You can read his columns, one of them, Antonin and Natural Law and Memories of Nino, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Hadley, thank you very much.
Thank you to post it. Oh, lovely to be with you, Todd. Thanks for having me on.